Good afternoon. So last time we talked about this idea of permissions, that our OS would enforce that programs that are running are allowed to do certain things, not allowed to do other things. And typically this is based on some policy set by the system administrator. And in our kind of most natural context for this, we had this idea that multiple people were sharing a machine, and we wanted to track that different people's programs were allowed to do different things. So one thing we need to do is we need to know, well, when we're running a program, who is it running for? And the mechanisms we learn for this, the ones that Unix typically uses, is that we track a user ID and a group ID for every running process, and that would tell us who it's running on behalf of. So we might have 5 copies of Emacs running on Portal, and we need to know for each of them what user is running it, so we can know what files is this copy of Emacs allowed to open, for example. And we need to have this set in some way. So typically we'll have a program that runs when you log in that will handle like getting your password and figuring out if that's okay. That will also be responsible for initially setting this user ID and then set for your shell, and it's going to be kind of inherited by all the other programs you run. We also mentioned some group IDs. So group IDs were basically ways where we could say we have a group of users, and we'll just assign this extra ID that we can use for things like, I want to give all students permission to access this, or all instructors permission to access this. The idea is we can assign a group ID to all their programs when they log in, and we can mark files with this group ID rather than enumerating every single instructor or student every time we need to do that. We mentioned a special user ID, super user or root. So often we'll have sort of programs installed by the system administrator that need to do things that we normally wouldn't allow users to do. One of these is our login program. Our login program can run a shell as any user. That's not something we just want any program to be able to do, but we need a program that does it, the one that runs when to let people log in. And a mechanism we'll have for doing that is that we'll have the special user ID that bypasses all permission checks, and our sort of initial programs will run as that and some other special programs. And we also mentioned, that we have connected with this, we had set user ID programs, and this was a way of sort of having installed programs that run with extra access. And the mechanism for that is that when you run them, they set the user ID of the process to a different one, and that means that these programs can do extra things. And one example we gave was the sudo program that's often exists on Linux, which I thought I had, yes. Which often exists on Linux, and I didn't explain fully last time, so some people were confused. So this is a program that some administrators install to let people do things with extra permissions. And the way it works is the program is marked set user ID, so it's marked that it runs as the user who owns it, which is the root user, that special user that bypasses permission checks. And the program basically has some if statements, which says, if you're one of the users configured by the administrator and you enter in the password, we'll let you run this command. If you're not one of those users, we won't. And this is done just in a normal program rather than us having to modify the core OS code that runs in kernel mode every time you want to change this policy. We also mentioned ways of setting permissions for files. So files are kind of the most obvious thing that we want to decide who can access them, especially on Unix, where a lot of things that wouldn't traditionally be files are represented as files, like, say, a mouse or a keyboard, as we may or may not talk about later. And there were two kind of permission mechanisms we talked about. One was this sort of Unix standard permissions that were supported everywhere that calls itself a Unix operating system or Linux everywhere, but we're very limited. For this, we could specify read, write, or execute for one user, one group, and everyone else for every file or directory. And the user there was called the owner, and they could also change those permissions. So it's kind of inflexible, but supported everywhere. And we learned about access control lists. So access control lists kind of generalized this. Rather than being able to specify just one user, one group, and everyone else, we can specify as many users as we want, as many groups as we want. And the user we specify doesn't have to be able to change all the permissions if we specify additional ones. So these access control lists were much more flexible, but not supported as much because, well, they're a lot more complicated to implement and store on the disk and all that. So questions about the permissions things we talked about last time? Yes?
How is the default group ID set when a file is created?
How is the default group ID set when a file is created? I believe it's the primary group ID your program is running at. So we mentioned that, you know, very briefly, that we had a different ways of getting group IDs. There was this get egid call. I believe it's the group ID returned by this. There's also a get groups call that gets a list of additional groups, and those probably would not be the default for a newly created file, but maybe this varies between different systems. Yes?
So does the system call that when you create a file, like it's just sort of invisible to you, right?
So the question is, how does the system, when you create a file, like store the user and group IDs for the file? This is going to be part of the code that implements the open system call most likely, or whatever else you use to create the file. And it's the right place to do it because it also implements all the permission checks to know what user ID should you be able to put there and all that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. Question, who the default values for a directory. So you mean values for the user and group ID?
Yeah.
That, again, I think probably follows the same rules as files. The way you create a directory is by making a system call. You aren't allowed to like directly write to the disk, because if you could do that, you could write things that don't fit the format the OS expects on the disk. Other questions about our permissions issues? Okay. And our last topic last time is about virtual memory. So this was how we implemented this mapping between the addresses you use and the addresses we actually see on the underlying machine. So we call the addresses we see in programs virtual addresses, and the address the machine sees physical addresses. And we need to define a function that mapped virtual addresses to physical addresses. And it turns out this function is going to be implemented by the processor, but set up by the OS. And to do this, we first divided up all the possible addresses into chunks we called pages. And these pages were always power of two chunks, starting at address 0 and then just keeping going. And because we divided up the addresses this way, it's convenient to go from an address to figure out how it relates to these pages. So we can look at the upper bits of the address, and that's always going to tell us the page number. So if we index the pages starting with 0 for the page that contains address 0, then do 1, 2, all the way up to however many pages we've divided up our addresses into, the upper bits of the addresses always tell us the page number. And we'll call the remaining bits the page offset, and that always tells us, given that we have this page that maybe it's, say, 4,096 bytes, it tells us where in that 4,096 bytes is this particular address. And once we divided up our memory addresses into pages, we have sort of the basic format of our mapping. It's going to be a table where for every virtual page, so every chunk of those addresses that the program sees, we're going to give up to one physical page, so a chunk of real addresses. And I say up to one, so sometimes you won't give any. That's the memory that if you access it, is a segment. Okay, so questions on virtual memory? Yes.
So like the other bits in the virtual, I guess, memory address is what we use to kind of correspond to the actual spot in memory, right?
So the upper bits of the virtual memory address are what we use to correspond to the actual spot in memory. So all the bits are used. We had this diagram last time. So our upper bits are what gets used for the table lookup. But we use the lower bits because what we get in the table is just like the area of memory, not the specific spot in that area. So we use the lower bits to figure out where in this big chunk of memory is this, does this access actually go. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
Can there be a mapping where there are more virtual memory than physical memory?
Is it possible for there to be more virtual memory addresses than physical memory addresses? Absolutely. In which case, probably, either all the rows of the table will not be marked as valid, will have holes, or will have some duplicates. Some will have places where the same virtual address maps to, two different virtual addresses map to the same physical address. That's something we can do in this table, even though maybe it doesn't make much sense most of the time. The question is this, what I've heard of this term swap, is having more virtual addresses than physical addresses what that's referring to? Basically, yes. The way that's implemented, as far as this page table is concerned, is that there will be things that are marked as invalid that won't really be invalid, and we'll talk about how that works later. You got a question over here? I guess not. Okay. Thought I saw a hand I missed. Okay. Yeah. Why are some virtual pages not given physical pages? So, if we look at sort of the layout of a program, often we have large regions of memory which aren't allocated, especially when we have like 64-bit addresses, where, well, if we think of the amount of memory it would take to fill between where I've decided to put my code and where I've decided to put my stack here, that's petabytes. You know, we're obviously not going to fill it in. So we'll have these holes where we just don't have allocated space. So the page table entries for those holes are going to be invalid. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Considering we're on the topic of virtual page, could you explain number 5 on the quiz?
Can I explain number 5 on the quiz? Okay. So we were given this virtual address. So we're going to take this virtual address, it's going to go through the mapping, and we're going to get a physical address. And the way that mapping is going to work is that we're going to first divide up this address into a page offset and a virtual page number. So we have a 12-bit page offset. So these lower 12 bits of the address are page offset, and the upper bits are our virtual page number. So virtual just because it came from a virtual address, not a physical address. And then we had our page table. And what this tells us to do is to figure out, you know, to use the page table, we're going to take this virtual page number here, and we're going to look up that row in our page table. And when we look that up, we find out that it, from what was on the quiz, that that row of the page table said it was valid and corresponded to physical page 2. And that process here corresponds on this picture to we're taking this value here, you know, that's the equivalent of our virtual page number, and getting the right row of the table and looking at the stuff in that row. And so if we look at this picture, the next step is we take what we got out of the page table and we combine it with our original page offset. So that's what we're going to do in this case. So we got physical page 2. If I write that in binary, I get 1, 1. So this is just 2. So that physical page 2. And I just copy the original page offset, get my physical address. That's what we're actually going to access memory at. and it ends up being 2234 when I convert it back to hexadecimal. Does that answer your question or follow-ups? Sure, back there. Yes, you.
Good.
So on question one on the quiz, can I go over the exceptions to signal pipeline?
Okay. Can I explain to you how adding it works and then correct me?
Can you? Sure.
So is it like, out of my code, I do divide by zero, I call an exception, I can shoot exception handler, and then that points to the handler, and then that handles from the signal back in the process, it's then handled by the signal handler either in the process or somewhere in the terminal.
So your question is, your understanding is when we use like a divide by zero, the processor goes to look up the exception handler, which is part of the OS, the kernel. It runs that, and that then triggers a signal handler. It triggers a signal which is either handled by the process or has some default action that the kernel implements. That understanding matches mine, yes? I think what confused people on the quiz is we talked about the exception table. And when we talk about exceptions, the exception table is the place where the OS stores for the processor the location of exception handlers. This is not a place we can store signal handlers because the way the processor runs an exception handler is different than how we want to run a signal handler. So like exception handlers run in kernel mode, we don't want to run signal handlers in kernel mode. Exception handlers have to deal with saving stuff and like aren't called like a normal function call. Signal handlers are. So the kernel needs to do this translation between how the exception handler is called and how the signal handler is called that the hardware doesn't know how to do because it doesn't know that processes exist. All it knows is that sometimes registers change from one set of registers to another set of registers. Is that, yes, other questions, yes. The question is the virtual page number is 4 bits, and it's 3 bits, and I wrote 4 bits on the slide. That is just an error on the slide of me being imprecise. And yeah, so the question is I would just get rid of the first bit.
Yeah, okay.
And yeah, so when I converted on this slide, I just converted the hexadecimal number. I wasn't paying attention to how many of those bits actually are part of the address.
Okay.
Sorry, yeah, question? So the question is, why would it be okay for me to ignore the first bit? So let's say I wrote this in binary, and I would write it as, you know, with the exact number of bits that are actually in our virtual addresses. In that case, I'd write this exact number, but without the first leading zero, the exact number I have written here. So I'd write this number here. Does that make sense? And if I asked you to convert that to hexadecimal, you'd still write 0x1234 because there was no way in hexadecimal for you to indicate, you know, that really we don't use all that first digit, hexadecimal digit. So it just ends up this way that the hexadecimal like doesn't precisely tell us how many bits are used. I'd also say generally, often I will write addresses where I won't write the address with all the leading zeros that might make sense. So for example, on this diagram here, probably I would usually write this address down here, something like this, just because I don't like writing lots of zeros. So you have to look at the context to figure out how big is the address really. Is that answer your question? Or
kind of. What makes you not say that the page number is not zero? Because if you take the first three bits are technically 000.
So the question is, what makes me say the page number is not zero? So I guess there's two ways we could look at this. So one is that the amount of stuff that isn't the page number is determined by the page size. And the page number is just whatever's left over. And if you think of this is how it works because of the reason why we could look at the upper bits and say that's the page number is just because if I have two-bit pages, or two-byte pages, then 0 and 1 are the first page, and 2 and 3 are the second page, and 4 and 5 are the next page, which means I can ignore the lower bit to get the page number. So that's sort of the general principle we're applying. So the most important thing is that our page offset size corresponds to our page size. The other way we could think of it is I could say, oh, with 3-bit page numbers and 12-bit page offsets, our addresses are 15 bits, and if I'm using the 3-bit page number, I better make sure I get a 15-bit number before I apply that rule. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
Shouldn't it be a
1-0 before here? Yes. This is what I get for making slides late at night. Other questions? Yeah. When a single handler runs, does a context switch occur? So, I would say if we're switching from one process to another, yes. So, like if you're killing, you know, like in our signal chat example, you were sending a signal to another process. To run that other signal handler, we better switch to another process first. Would say if it's in the same process, I wouldn't call it a context switch because it looks more like a function call, just a function call where we save things in a weird way. Before the function call and restore things in a weird way after.
So on question 2 on the quiz, it asked about RDI, mm-hmm. and I believe that RDI is calling save.
So the question is, hey, we asked when a single handler runs, what happens to RDI after the single handler returns? And we know the way single handlers are supposed to work is that you run the single handler, you handle the signal, and then it goes back to the code that was there. And for that code to work normally, something better be making RDI not change. And the way that works on Linux is that when Linux runs your signal handler, it saves registers like RDI before calling your signal handler. And it saves them on your stack, it turns out, and restores them when you return. Does that answer your question? Yes. So the question is, I said when a page is invalid, it maps to that gray space, but doesn't like the stack grow, and wouldn't that make this not work? Yes, you are correct. So I have glossed over some things that operating systems do where this picture will differ from what's in the page table. And we'll talk about that probably as kind of our last set of topics about virtual memory. Other questions? Okay, so some stuff. So some anonymous feedback. I think you cut people off during their questions too much. Probably. I will try to work on this. From my perspective, probably what's happening is I think, oh, I know what they're asking, and I'm always in a hurry. Things about lab times being crowded. And people staying for multiple lab sessions. So, unfortunately, room availability at 3:30 makes this very hard to find good options for. Like, ideally, I could just get another classroom in Alston and we could move some TAs from 6:30 to 3:30 because everyone wants that time anyways. But we can't do that. I will say that we might enforce that if the lab is full, we might enforce that, hey, if you're not registered for 3:30, sorry. Need to give priority for 3:30. But yes, I'm aware lab crowdedness is a weird problem. I don't know of a great solution without really cracking down and going to the wrong lab time, which doesn't seem like it would be great for everyone. And I hope not to have to do that. My hope is that also being able to start labs a little early or work and things like that will give more flexibility for this. And then saying, hey, your in-class example questions are good. Can we have more of them? Can I have some that we can take after the class, you know, between class sections? I do indeed try to have in-class examples, mainly so I don't lecture too fast through a topic. How many of them I have probably is mostly based on how many times I've taught the thing before than anything else. I'm not sure about like giving, you know, kind of sort of homework on your own questions of this sort, just because my experience is that people, that too much of the class will just completely ignore it if it's not great, which is an unfortunate thing. And that wouldn't make it very useful if it's, well, they won't ignore it if it's in lecture, but they'll ignore it if it's, you know, something I give on Thursday and say we'll talk about Tuesday. Okay, so last time we were talking about this page table. Look, so we get our address, we split it up into the page offset, that size based on our page size, and the virtual page number. We take that virtual page number, we look that up in our page table, we check if it's valid. If it's not valid, we trigger an exception, ask the OS, hey, what do you want to do about this? And if it is valid, we combine that the physical page number we look up with the page offset from the original address. So this is setting the sort of how the page table works. Now, there's something we need to do to like to set the page table. The way this is going to work is that we're going to have extra privilege instructions to do that. So we'll talk about, we talked about privilege instructions, so we'll have privilege instructions for setting this page table, you know, and we'll, that's how we'll deal with, you know, making it so the OS can change the page table, but ordinary programs can't. Why don't you want ordinary programs to change the page table directly? Well, because if you could put any number here, you can access anyone's memory. That's probably a bad thing on something like Portal to let people do. Yes?
Where is the actual mapping of the page table stored?
Where is the actual mapping of the page table stored? That is going to be our next topic. So right now it seems like, oh, we'll just have some special memory for it. We'll see that that doesn't quite work, so we'll have a different solution. And then we'll see that the different solution doesn't quite work, so we'll have a different way of storing the page table too after that. So to get to that, let's talk about the sizes of addresses. So in initially talking about these page tables, I kind of gave the impression the virtual address size, that's the size of a program address. Oh, so that must be the size of a pointer. So often this is true, but sometimes, and in fact on most 64-bit x86 systems, not all of the pointer is used. So typical 64-bit x86 systems only use 48 bits of the pointer to actually look up the physical address. And the way the other bits work is that they have to all be copies of the highest most bit, so they have to all be ones or all zeros. So they're checked in that way, but they aren't actually used to look things up in the page table. They're just all zeros or all ones. And this is just because this would make our page table size kind of infeasible. And when I'm talking about the virtual address size, I mean the size that's used for the mapping. So in the case of 64-bit x86, which typically only uses 48 bits, I mean it's 48-bit virtual addresses, even though our pointers are 64-bit, because a bunch of those bits don't actually matter when we're using the page table. And sometimes I'll talk about the size of an address space. So we said that what we created with page tables was this address space, this illusion that a program has its own memory. And if a program has 32-bit virtual addresses, I'll say it has a 2 to the 32-byte virtual address space size. And I'm going to say this even though, very likely, that doesn't mean you can access 2 to the 32 different things in practice, because some of your page table entries are going to be marked invalid. Similarly, if we have after the translation, 20-bit physical addresses. I'll say we have a 2 to the 20 byte physical address size, but very often, that doesn't mean we actually have 2 to the 20 bytes of memory. We might have a smaller amount. And if you want to think of, well, why would this be the case? Let's think of a machine with 3 gigs of memory. There's just no way of making that work with any size. If I have 32-bit physical addresses, that's 4 gigs. If I have 31-bit, that's 2 gigs. So obviously there's going to be some leftover space where we have a physical address that doesn't correspond to anything. And often there's much, much more, because like my desktop, it may have came with 16 gigs of memory, but maybe it supports 128. And the way that usually works is not that the physical address size is changing, it's staying the same. When we're talking about the address space size, we mean kind of like what the size the hardware uses, regardless of whether all those addresses are actually feasible. So question back there? Question, why would I mark something invalid? So let's go back to our example here. So here, I have this bunch of space between the stack and the heap. If it's not allocated, I need to put something in the page table. So I'm going to mark it as invalid because I don't want to give the program that memory. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah?
Why does 2 to 32 bits map to 2 to 32 bytes?
Why did I say 32 to the 32 bytes instead of 2 to the 32 bits? Because, and this is because if I take any 32-bit value, that gives me a specific byte. So at address 0, the byte there, that's 8 bits, it's not 1 bit. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So let's say we have 32-bit virtual addresses, and I have 4,096 byte pages. First question here, how many virtual pages do I have? So I'll give you a little bit of time, check with your neighbors that you agree on what the calculation is for this. Who'd like some more time? So who can give me an answer here? Any volunteers? Redshirt.
Would it be 2 to the 20?
2 to the 20? How did you get that?
I divided. So like if you have like the, if each page is 4,096 bytes to the 12, that means the offset has to be that. It has to be 12 bits.
Okay. So you said, okay, I have 32-bit addresses, and I know we have 2 to the 12 bytes in each page. I need 12 bits to identify which byte I'm referring to. So there must be a 12-bit page offset. The rest is the page number. That gives me 2 to the 20 bytes for that. So that would give me that. So it gives you 20 bits for that, which means there's 2 to the 20 possible values for the page number. So that's 2 to the 20 pages. So that's one way you can figure it out. Another way that might be reasonable is you can say there are 2 to the 32 unique bytes we can address, potentially, and they're divided up into 2 to the 12 byte units, and we got the same number. We got that there's 2 to the 20 things that are divided up into. Some questions? These two ways of figuring this out. Okay. So, let's do a more interesting exercise here. So let's say I have 32-bit virtual addresses and 30-bit physical addresses, and the same page size, so 2 to the 12 bytes, 4,096 bytes, and my page table entries, I'll make this simpler because we didn't talk about that. So our page table entries, let's say they have a physical page number and a valid bit. So my question is, how big is my page table? And you might say, gosh, this seems like a really small page size. It's not. This is the actual page size on 32-bit x86. And obviously also the actual virtual address size on 32-bit x86. So, question back there?
Yeah, so we're ignoring the kernel a little bit here. Are we adjusting so we have 31 bits to the page number and the valid bit, or just?
So the question is, since we're ignoring this kernel mode only bit I talked about, does that mean we're adjusting the physical page number? Nope. We haven't talked about what I mean by kernel mode only bit. We'll talk about that later. Someone give me a first step to do when solving this problem. Just a first step. Something that should help us out that we want to know. Yes?
Well, the first thing I think about is to decide whether the page table is going to have it's going to map every virtual address, or it's going to map every physical address.
So the question is, think about the rows of the page table first. So I think that's a nice idea. Something back there? Yeah.
So I think that it will still be, I don't think it matters how many physical addresses you have, because all that matters is that each possible virtual address has some mapping. If it's valid, if there's less hardware addresses, then you can just make them invalid.
Okay. So you think, so your thinking is initially, we need some mapping for each possible virtual address. So I think that's a good way of thinking about it. So if we think about our page table, we have a bunch of rows, and the number of rows, this is something, this is related to the number of virtual addresses in some way. There's something about the virtual addresses that decides how many rows there are. And that seems like a good thing to figure out for deciding about the table. That seems like a good first step. So someone tell me, how can we figure out how many rows should be in the page table? What does that correspond to? Yeah?
The number of virtual pages.
Number of virtual pages. If we look back at our page table here, I had a row for each virtual page. So if we know how many virtual pages there are, that would tell me how many rows there are. And well, we just did that problem. We figured out how many virtual pages there are. 2 to the 20. Okay, so we have 2 to the 20 rows. Now, that doesn't tell us the whole story about how big the page table is, because we haven't figured out how wide it is. So to figure that out, well, I'm told that each entry, so this is entry equals row, has a physical page number and a valid bit. So I need to figure out how much space those take up. So the valid bit probably takes up 1 bit. How about the physical page number? Someone tell me, how would I figure out how much space that takes up? Really, someone who hasn't done it. Yes, Becca.
What did it take up 18 bits?
Okay.
Because the last 12 bits are going to be the page offset, so the first 18 would be the page number.
Okay, so you're saying we have our, if we have a physical address, that's going to be a physical page number and a page offset. And we know these page offsets are 12 bits. And if we subtract 30 from 12, that gives us 18 left over. And exactly, yes. So that would give us 18 bits for our physical page number. So the total size of our page table, therefore, is going to be 2 to the 20, the number of rows, times 18 plus 1. And this is in bits. So this is that number of bits. And this is, you know, about 3 megabytes. Question?
Do you not have to store, like, the virtual address that you're mapping in the, like,
so the question is, gosh, I mentioned the physical page and the valid bit, but if we look back at this slide here, didn't we have the virtual page number in there? So the only thing we have to store is what's shown in the box in this slide. The virtual page number here, that's just a row number. We don't need to store that. We can just know what that is based on how far we went into the table. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Oh, right. And let's do another little exercise. So let's say I have this virtual address here, and I want to split it up into page number and page offset. Same sizes as before. So anyone want more time? Okay. So when I look at this, as I'd say, our pages are true to the 12 bytes, so we need 12 bits to determine the page offset, that is where on a page we are. And those are always the least significant bits, because if we advance by one byte in memory, we want to be, you know, mostly in the same page, just because our pages are like continuous collections of bytes. So the last 12 bits of this number have to be our page offset, and it happens that because each of these hexadecimal digits is 4 bits, that if I think of this number in binary, like this is, if this is bit 0, that's 4, that's 8, that's 12, so I can just take the value of the last 12 bits, and that's my page offset, and everything left over is my page number. Now, if I happen to have a page size that wasn't a multiple of 4, I probably need to do something like say, oh, we convert 8 maps to 0100, and 7 maps to 0100, 10111, and so on, and then I could, you know, I could divide up the bits if I need to do that. But here, I don't have to actually work with bits because I'm all working with groups of 4 bits, and that's what a hexadecimal digit is. Question back there, yes? Question about this, about this exercise?
Yeah, so we did 18 plus 1, but why is it not true to the 18 plus
1? Why is it not true to the 18 plus 1? So if we look at our example page table here, the 18 represents how big these things are. So those are 18 bits. If we look at each row, we have just 18 bits. We don't have like 2 to the 18. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So let's go back to this problem. We said this page table is 3 meg. That seems a little big. And in particular, it definitely seems too big to fit on our processor. So where are we going to store this? And the answer is, there's 2 things. So one thing is we're going to store it in memory. And there's a second part we'll talk about later, which is that we're not actually going to store all of it. But first, let's talk about how can we store this in memory? How is that going to work? And what we're going to do is the processor is going to decide that we're going to represent each page table entry as an integer. So we're going to decide some way of mapping integers to page table entries. So in this example, my hypothetical processor has decided that we're going to store page table entries by writing them as a 16-bit integer, and the most significant bit of that integer is the valid bit. The next 11 bits are a physical page number, and then we have some other bits that might be unused. So that's why we're going to store page table entries, and they're just going to be integer values in memory. And we're going to have an array of integer values in memory to represent the rows of our table. And when the OS wants to tell the processor to use a particular page table, it's not going to tell the processor about every row of the table. It's just going to give the processor a memory address by setting a special register called the page table base register. So that's going to point to memory, and memory is going to contain a bunch of integers, an array of integers, that when interpreted using this format the processor decided, tell us what the page table entries are. So the processor is going to know that if I want the first page table entry, the valid bit of it is this 0 here. If I want the physical page number from the first page table entry, that's these bits here, and so on. So we can read out from memory to figure out the contents of the page table logically, and the processor is going to do this kind of as we access memory. Okay, so we can have all these most significant bits of these numbers are going to be all the valid bits in a page table, for example. And all the next bits are going to be all the physical page numbers. And if we have other things we want to store in the page table, we have space for them. And if we don't, well, We're just wasting a little bit of space to make accessing a particular row more convenient. So a question back there. Yes.
Why do you get rid of the kernel bit?
Why do they get rid of the kernel bit? We'll add them back later, but it's just other bits, anything else we might want, that's gonna be there.
Okay.
Yes. So the question is, all x86 64 processors would have the same page table entry layout. So if you pull out AMD or Intel's manuals, you'll discover that there's like 5 or 6 different page table entry layouts that the processor supports, and the OS can configure that by setting another special register. But it's still the case that the processor decides what those formats are, because the processor is doing the job of reading the memory. Does that answer your question? Question, is it going to be the same formats for every x86 64 processor? Basically yes, because otherwise we'd have to like rewrite our OS for every processor, every model of processor or something like that. Yes?
When a spec fault happens, does it happen during the stage where it search up the page table and see that the 15-bit is invalid, or does it happen afterwards when it goes to the physical memory?
So the question is, if a seg fault happens, where in this process does it happen? So I have a diagram which might help us with that on the next slide. So what we're going to do to act, what the processor is going to do is we're going to take our virtual address. We're going to split it up into our virtual page number and our page offset. We're going to figure out how to index our array using our page table base register as the base address of the array and our virtual page number as the index into the array. When we're indexing into array, we advance by the number of bytes equal to the index times the size of each element. So that's why I'm multiplying by the size of each entry. And we're going to access memory there. Then we're going to get out of the page table entry, and that's going to give us a physical address and also some other bits, like the valid bit. And at this point, we're going to check this valid bit and potentially cause a fault of some sort, like a segmentation fault. And if the check goes OK, we're going to combine that physical address with the page offset and access memory a second time to complete the access. And the second time, we're accessing the actual data of the program once. The first time, we're accessing this page table entry to figure out where the data of the program once is. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes. Why do I multiply by the page table size? So if we think of our table here, if my virtual page is 1, I don't want to go to address 1 because that's in the middle of the first page table entry. I want to go to address 2. So we're accounting for the fact that our page table entries usually aren't 1 byte. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes. So the question is that checking the kernel mode only bit. So any other bits we'll want, we'll talk. I plan on talking later about all the other bits we might want in the page table. We're just doing the basic lookup now. But yes, if we want to do other things with our page table entries, this is where we'll do them. We can do any other checks we want to do based on other data in the page table entry. And we'll talk about why that's useful much later. Yes. The question, what's the usual page table entry size? So in my example, it was 2 because that fits on the slide well. On a typical system, it's going to be 4 or 8 bytes these days. Could be bigger. It's usually going to be a power of 2 because we want the multiplication to actually be a bit shift. We like don't want to multiply by 7 every time you access memory. That would not be convenient. So usually it's a power of 2 and probably 4 or 8. Other questions? Yeah.
Can you go over how you figured out the page table entry size in your example?
How did I figure out the page table entry size? When the processor was defining how things are going to work for the OS, it chose this layout. So whoever designs the processor gets to choose what the layout of the page table entry is, and that's going to define its size. As for how big it needs to be, I didn't go into explicitly why did I choose 2 bytes here, but presumably the reason I did that is because if I have physical page numbers that are this big, I can't choose 1 byte, and I want a whole number of bytes, or else it's really hard to access memory. I can't really advance by like 1.5 bytes. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, and a terminology thing, we call the part of the processor that does this translation and lookup the memory management units. You might see that term commonly for you, the MMU. Questions about this page table lookup? Okay, so let's do a little exercise here. So here, can I do the interesting version? Let's do the interesting version. Okay, so let's say here, have this example here where I have the contents of memory, which is a bunch of bytes. And let's say we're gonna use like really small numbers so it fits on the slide. We have 6-bit virtual addresses and 6-bit physical addresses and 8-byte pages. So physical page 0 are these first 8 bytes, physical page 1 is these second 8 bytes, and so on. And my page table in this example, rather than being stored separately, is gonna be stored in the memory. And the way my page tables works is I have a physical page number stored in the most significant bits of a 1-byte page table entry, then a valid bit, and then 4 bits I'm not using. And my page tables take up 1 page. This is going to be 8 bytes. And in this case, I've set my page table base register to this address 20. And that means that these 8 bytes here are my page table. So this is my page table, but it's stored as bytes, and to actually access them, the processor has to translate those bytes back to page table entries. And it's stored as 1-byte numbers in this case, because that's the format I decided on in this question. Okay, and since it's 1-byte numbers, this is our first. D0 is our first page table entry, D1 is our second, and so on. Those are our rows of our page table are stored there. And the question here is, let's translate this virtual address 3-1. And as a hint, a useful first step here is to write this in binary. If I translate each hex digit, I get 00110001, but we know it's only 6-bit addresses, so these leading zeros aren't part of the address that's actually used. So that's our address. So what would be a good next step to take? Something that would be useful to do. To do this lookup. Yes?
Like the physical address translation. Like from the virtual page number to the physical page number.
Okay, so we want to find out the physical page number?
Yeah.
Okay, I think that's a good plan. So where are we gonna find that? Okay, so you want to first multiply by the page table entry size. Okay, so let's look at that. So what's being multiplied by the page table entry size here is we have our page number needs to be multiplied by the page table entry size. All right, that's the index in the page table we want to access. So I like the idea of multiplying by the page table entry size, but we first need to get the page number out of this address. How can we do that? Yeah. Okay, you say you want to subtract the last 2 bits? Last two,
right?
last two because it's 8 by page. So 8 is 2 to the third. So I think you mean 3. But yes, exactly. We want to just get rid of the last bits because we know the address is split up into a page number and a page offset. So we're going to extract the part of the address here. That's going to be, this is going to be our page number. So we're going to take that. That's our page number. And that tells us what index in the page table we go to. So our page table entries here, we have the entry with, we have here the entry with index 0, then 1, then 2, then 3, then 4, then 5, then 6, then 7. Those are our page table entries. And our page number here is 6, if we translate it back from binary. So this page number here, this is equals to 6. So we want the entry at right here. That's going to be the corresponding page table entry. So questions on how I figured out that that was the page table entry? Yes?
How did you go from the page number to the entry?
How did I go from the page number to the entry? So I know my page table is an array of page table entries. And I know page table entries, because I said in the question, are 1 byte. So I just said the first byte here, that's the page table entry 0. Second byte is the page table entry for 1. Then for 2, 3, and so on. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. What does PPN and MSP stand for? PPN stands for physical page number. And MSB stands for most significant bit. Most significant bit being like where the sign's place would be. Does that answer your question? Yes. Where did the 110001 come from? That is just a translation into binary of this address here. Yes? What happens if the PTE size was not 1? Then instead of counting out 1 byte at a time, I'd count out more than 1 byte at a time. Would that affect the index? So the index would be the same, but the way I'd get to that index would be different. So for example, if our PTE size was 2 bytes, then our first page table entry would be D0, D1, and our second page table entry would be D2, D3, then F4, F5, F6, F7, and so on. And so to get to entry number 6, I'd end up at this ABBC. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Would it not be at CDDE?
Would it not be at CDDE? You are correct. I can't count. Other questions? Okay. So we get page number 6. So we have this page table entry here. So I want to decode it. So I'm going to write this as bits, and it's 1111 0 110. And I'm told that starting at the most significant bit, which is the, not the ones place, but the other end of the number, that I have 3 bits, which are a physical page number. So my page number must be these 3 bits. This is my physical page number. And then I have a valid bit. And then I have some unused bits. So decoding this, I figure out, my physical page number is all ones, so I'm going to use this physical page number to form my new address. So I have 1111, and I'm going to combine that with my original page offset, which was the rest of the address, 01. So that's the final address I actually access. And so what I'm doing there is, so I'm taking the thing from the page table, that's this upper part, and the thing from the original address, the bottom bits of that, that's the lower part, just combining them. That's the operation I'm doing here. So I get this address 111001. So the first I have something I copy from a page table entry, that's our physical page number. I have my page offset I copy from the original address, that's where we are in the page. So questions? We do that. Yes. Question, does the valid bit not necessarily have to be the first bit? That's correct. It's and up to the processor how the page table is laid out, because it's the one that's reading it. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes. So the question is, it looks like I have a whole bunch of virtual pages that go to the same physical page. Is that allowed? Absolutely. The processor will do that for you. Would your OS want to do that? Usually no, but it's allowed. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
What is 8-byte pages? Does it mean there's 8-byte pages?
Question, what does 8-byte pages mean? That means each page is 8 bytes, so we've divided up the memory into 8-byte chunks. So our first 8-byte chunk is here, our second 8-byte chunk is here, and so on. For the physical memory, and the virtual addresses are divided in the same way. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I've gotten this address. This is a physical address, and I'm going to convert it back to hexadecimal for convenience. So this is 0x39. And I look up here, so the value we'll read is that 0C. That's the value we'll end up accessing. Because remember, the address we get, that's not the number we're going to get in our program. We're actually going to get the thing from memory. We're going to like read or write it. So questions on finishing this? This question, when I convert the hex back, I get 39. And what is that value? So if the program was trying to access address 31, 39 is the actual address it would access. And therefore, the value I circled, that's the place in memory it would be reading or writing, depending on what instruction was trying to use address 31. Does that answer your question? Yes. So the question is, do we have several page tables in memory at the same time, or do we write the page table? Usually, we'll have several page tables in memory at the same time, and we'll just change this page table base register. Okay. Other questions? Question is, would the final answer be 39, the physical address, or 0C, the value there? Depends what we ask for in an answer. If we ask for the physical address, we want 39. We ask for what value would you read or what value would you overwrite, we want 0C. Other questions?
Could you elaborate more on getting from 39
to 0C? Can I elaborate more on getting from 39 to 0C? So if we look back at this diagram here, in our example, this is what 39 is. But we actually want to send this to the memory to access some value. And the value that's in the memory that we're going to get out, that's going to be 0C. Does that answer your question?
I meant how to convert like 39 to 0C.
Oh, so the question is, how do I convert 39 to 0C? I just have, in the table I write here for the contents of memory, I see that this row, because of the key, contains addresses 38 to 3B. So 3/8 the first one, so the next one must be 3/9. The first byte, I should say. Yeah. Other questions? Okay, so I guess in our remaining 5 minutes, I'll give a preview of to come. So I talked about 32-bit systems. On my desktop, it's a 64-bit system, and it supports 39-bit virtual addresses and 48-bit virtual addresses and 39-bit physical addresses, and still has pages that are only 2 to the 12 bytes. So if we do the calculation we did before for how big our page table is, so we saw in that toy example, it was 8 bytes. How big is it going to be for this system? Well, how many page table entries do we have? This is the same calculation we did for the 32-bit system. We're going to say I have 2 to the 48 bytes divided by 2 to the 12 bytes per page. Page, that gives me 2 to the 36 virtual pages. That's several billion. And my physical page numbers, if we do that calculation, we say, oh, our physical addresses, we have 39 bits in total. We're going to split that up into a 12-bit page offset, and what's left over is going to be 27 bits for a physical page number. So if we calculate how big this page table is, we run into a problem. And actually, it's a worse problem, because if I look up the page table entry format, page table entries aren't 27, like 28 bits. They're 8 bytes, 64 bits. So my page table would take up 2 to the 39 bytes. That's half a terabyte. So obviously, that's not what my desktop does. I don't have a desktop with several terabytes of memory. So what's actually happening? Well, we're going to have some technique to save space. And we're going to talk more about sort of exactly how this works next time. And I'll give the sort of the high-level overview of why can we save space? Why can I still use this page table idea, but somehow not use that much space? And the big insight is I told you that we have these holes. We have these invalid pages. And we have not only some of them, we have these big ranges. Because if you think of your typical 64-bit program, the space between your stack and the heap, that's like many petabytes. And so our basic idea is we're going to find some way of storing the information in our table, but in a format where we don't have to store those big ranges of empty pages. And we're going to do that by not storing our table as an array, but in some data structure that isn't an array. And when I've asked people, how would you do this? And you've taken like DSA-1, the most common answer I get is a great idea, and it's to use a hash table. And there have been processors which do that. They exist. It's not the most common solution. Instead, the most common solution is a tree data structure. So we're going to have some tree data structure, but this isn't going to look like the trees you're used to. The tree is going to be a very bushy tree. So we're going to have nodes with lots of children, basically. And why are we going to do that? Because this is going to allow us to not do too many memory accesses to traverse the tree. And we'll talk about what this structure looks like next time. And we'll see that the tree nodes, are basically little page tables of the format we saw before.